I'm Jen White. This is 1A. For centuries, speculative fiction has transported readers to new worlds that seem limitless. But one thing that hasn't been limitless about the genre is who's been telling those stories. Like many other types of fiction, speculative fiction is hinged on a Eurocentric worldview with mostly white male storytellers at the helm. But a wave of Native authors is turning the genre on its head by reimagining past and future worlds with Native characters at the center. And two of those authors join us now. With us from Colorado is Stephen Graham Jones. His latest novel is called The Only Good Indians, and he's a member of the Blackfeet tribe. Stephen, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Connecticut is Darcy Little Badger. Her new debut novel is called Alatsowe, and she's a member of the Lipan Apache tribe. Darcy, welcome.
Oh, hello. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to hear from both of you about how you first got into this genre, what kinds of stories you read growing up, how they influenced you. Stephen?
You know, when I was 11, probably, my uncle gave me access to his closet full of mass market paperbacks, and his taste veered towards the fantastic, including westerns and action. So I could take three of his books at a time, and once I finished with those, I could get three more, and I worked through his whole closet that way. And I think my taste is largely because that was his taste.
So you had your own private library there.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Darcy, what about you?
Oh, yeah, I actually started reading very young. My parents really emphasized the importance of storytelling in my life. I think there's even a picture of me at age 12 reading from a picture book. But growing up, some of the works that kind of transformed how I think about science fiction, fantasy, horror were, okay, do you remember Goosebumps?
Yes.
So I was so into Goosebumps. I read like every Goosebumps. And also the Red Wall series. And thinking back, I think it's because like the little badgers and the mice and the stuff reminded me a lot of the characters in the stories that were actually traditional Lipan stories. So I was like assuming that these badgers that I was reading about were like the badgers that I grew up with my mom telling me about. So those are some two series that I really loved.
Well, I started reading speculative fiction when I was a little girl too, you know, stealing books from my older siblings. I'm a Black woman, and I didn't always see myself in those stories. It wasn't until I was much older that I started to discover other writers, Black women writers like Octavia Butler. But Stephen, for you, to what extent did you see yourself in the stories other people were telling?
I never did until seventh grade, when my English teacher assigned Hal Borland's When the Legends Die. It's a novel about a guy named Thomas Black Bull from early childhood until his 30s or 40s, I believe. And that was the first time in my life I had seen a Native person not be just a shooting dummy in a book, you know? And it was so refreshing to watch, to see the progression across the years. Like, it was neat to see a Native person moving into the future, you know, because in the stories I was, in the other stuff I was reading, in the Westerns especially, the Indians were just, you know, mountain lions, basically, that would come out of the dark or whatever and jump on you. And that's not very helpful, you know?
Yeah. Darcy, what about for you?
Oh, boy. So I was a voracious reader. And if you think about the elements that make up a person, like I'd see certain components of my identity more frequently than others. Like I'd read sci-fi fantasy stories about girls or about nerds. I never read one about a Lipan Apache character, and I really didn't read many about Native characters. Actually, it wasn't until like junior high when I read X-Men comic book from the 80s and introduced this character, Danny, who's Cheyenne, but I actually related to a lot of the like experiences she went through as a Native character, and that's in comic books.
Stephen, your latest novel, The Only Good Indians, came out in July. For people who haven't read it yet, just give us a quick rundown about, you know, what it's about.
Four guys are out hunting elk on the Blackfeet Reservation this last Saturday before Thanksgiving, and they end up committing a kind of crime or trespass against both the elk and their community. And they leave that day thinking everything's all right, you know, no bad, no harm, no foul. But 10 years later, something from that day remembers what happened and is now coming for them.
Now, you've picked out a passage to read to us. Briefly, what's happening in this scene?
What's happening is the one of those four hunters is up on a ladder in his living room trying to fix the light bulb, and he's me, basically, I guess. Sometimes I think I don't make things up enough, you know?
Well, I'd love to hear you read.
All right, I gotta put my glasses on. I always forget to do that. All right, here we go. Lewis is standing in the vaulted living room of his and PETA's new rent house, staring straight up at the spotlight over the mantel, daring it to flicker on now that he's looking at it. So far, it only comes on with its thready glow at completely random times. Maybe in relation to some arcane and unlikely combination of light switches in the house, or maybe from the iron being plugged into a kitchen socket while the clock upstairs isn't, or is, plugged in. And don't even get him started on all the possibilities between the garage door and the freezer and the floodlights aimed down at the driveway. It's a mystery is what it is. But, more important, it's a mystery he's going to solve as a surprise for PETA, and in the time it takes her to drive down to the grocery store and back for dinner. Outside, Harley, Lewis's Malamutant, is barking steady and pitiful from being tied to the laundry line, but the barks are already getting hoarse. He'll give it up soon enough, Lewis knows. Unhooking his collar now would be the dog training him instead of the other way around. Not that Harley's young enough to be trained anymore, but not like Lewis is either, really. Lewis imagines he deserves some big Indian award for having made it to 36 without pulling into the drive-thru for a burger and fries, easing away with diabetes and high blood pressure and leukemia. And he gets the rest of the trophies for having avoided all the car crashes and jail time and alcoholism on his cultural dance card. Or maybe the reward for lucking through all that, meth too, he guesses, is having been married 10 years now to PETA, who doesn't have to put up with motorcycle parts soaking in the sink, with the drips of Wolf brand chili he always leaves between the coffee table and the couch, with the tribal junk he always tries to sneak up onto the walls of their next house.
We learned so much about the character in that section, and I remember reading it and just, you build so many layers onto him. How are you approaching character development in these stories?
You know, that's such a hard question, how to do character development, because it's like I feel my way through, I guess. I stick a guy up on a ladder, and I think what would make him interesting. And what makes him interesting if he's got a past that is now coming to, like, knock him off that ladder or something. And then once he needs a pass, that pass has to be interesting. And I've got to think about what he did that's now coming for him. And pretty soon the whole novel's happening.
I want to unpack the title, The Only Good Indians. You said in interviews that it's a reference to a quote by Teddy Roosevelt. Tell us more about that connection.
Yeah, I wanted to come at that, really. That old bumper sticker from the 19th century, you know? I was worried, using this title, that was going to give people permission to start saying it again, you know, because of course it's fallen away as it needs to, but I also wanted to interrogate what it means in 2020 to be a good Indian. You know, all these characters in here are trying to figure that out for themselves, and it turns out that there's not a single way to be a good Indian. It's not about adhering to the old ways. It's not about adopting new ways. It's not about success here or success in this other field or whatever. There's 7 million different ways to be a good Indian, because that's how many of us there are. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow there'll be more.
We're talking to authors Stephen Graham Jones and Darcy Little Badger about their latest works of speculative fiction. Now, Darcy, you released your debut young adult novel, Alatsoe, in August, and the titular protagonist is a teenager who goes by the nickname Ellie. Tell us briefly about her and where her story goes.
Oh, yes. So Ellie, whose full name is Alatsoe, actually based on my grandmother's name, it means hummingbird in the Lipan language. So she's a 17-year-old living in a version of the United States that's very similar to the contemporary U.S. that we live in now, with a few exceptions. For example, Ellie is able to wake the ghosts of animals, which is a skill that has been passed down since her sixth great-grandmother kind of originated with her. And there's also things like fairy rings. But Ellie's cousin is murdered, and the authorities are like, well, this looks like an accident. It was certainly set up to resemble an accident. But Ellie actually knows that a wealthy doctor named Abe Allerton killed him. The thing is, she doesn't know why or how. So she launches this investigation with the help of her friends and family and her ghost dog in this really creepy town in South Texas.
Well, as someone who has two living dogs at home, the ghost dog was one of my favorite parts of the book, that she had that companionship. But tell us about the passage you picked out. I'd love to hear you read.
Yes. So as I mentioned, Ellie is able to wake up the ghosts of dead animals, and this also includes prehistoric ghosts. So I decided to read a passage where throughout this book up to chapter 15, which is where we jump in, she has this fossil trilobite, and she's been kind of connecting with it and bringing this ghost trilobite back. And until this point, it seems like a very, like, harmless endeavor. That's not the case. Anyway, Ellie hadn't brought the trilobite fossil, but she knew its shape and personality by heart. She called its hologram-dense body from the ether. As a child, when Ellie daydreamed about dinosaurs, they seemed mythological. In a distant way, young Ellie understood that prehistoric animals came from the same planet as humans, breathed the same air, and saw the same sun and moon. Now it surprised her how familiar the trilobite ghost was. Its appearance and behavior reminded her of horseshoe crabs, lobsters, roaches, and many other beasties that shared her slice of time. Why not? After all, they were kin. The similarities among Earthlings, dead or alive, outnumbered their differences. Ellie wanted to meet every species on the Tree of Life, witness the ghosts of its oldest branches, velociraptors, giant sloths, megalodon sharks. As Ellie watched the trilobite scuttle over a clump of yellow grass, she heard a whisper of sound. She concentrated, and the sound swelled louder and multitudinous, as if an army of trilobites swarmed under her feet, crawling on the memory of a deep seafloor. Ellie jumped off the bench and backed away from the park, concentrating on anything but ghosts, but she could still hear the trilobites swarming. Did she accidentally wake them up? How? That had never happened before. Luckily, no one else seemed to notice the ruckus. Not the middle-aged jogger with a sweatband around his forehead, not the woman checking her mail, or the family having a barbecue in their front yard. In fact, nobody seemed to notice Ellie. I'm going to stop there, but this is where the ghost ocean actually emerges.
Why did you want to write a book for young adults?
I actually started this book as an adult book. But I got like 10, 20,000 words in, and it just wasn't coming. And I realized that's because the voice of the main character had to belong to someone who's a teenager, to someone who is trying to seek justice without, like, much support, you know, that an adult would get. So I think that's actually what caused this book specifically to take this turn. But in general, I'm writing another young adult book, and it is because, like, growing up, so many, like, of my joys as a teenager, the things that brought me comfort and helped me escape from difficulties were books. And I just really hope that I'm able to provide that for maybe another young Native reader out there.
Well, as a not-so-young adult, I enjoyed reading it, even though I may not have been the target audience for it. Stephen, you write horror books, and I'm curious what it is about that genre that helps you dive into, you know, deeper issues like vengeance or what justice means.
You know, I think whatever I was writing would be dealing with issues of justice or fairness or trying to make sense of the world. It's just horror is the tool I've got. I mean, when you're in horror land, like if you're writing zombies, a zombie is just like a blank metaphoric space you can pour metaphor into, basically, to talk about what you want. And a lot of horror can work like that. A lot of fiction can work like that. Really, it's not specific to horror, but horror is really good for reflecting back our own anxieties and fears, of course. But, you know, the reason I choose horror, I really like the visceral response that a horror story or novel or film or show can provoke from the reader. I like to watch people read horror, to watch them cringe or kind of shy away from the pages. That's wonderful. I like to hide around the corner in a mask and scare people and dogs. So.
Good to know, Stephen. Really good to know. Well, Black sci-fi writer N.K. Jemisin has said she writes speculative fiction because, quote, every single one of us, no matter who we are and no matter what's been taken from us or what poison we've internalized or how hard we've had to work to expel it, we all get to dream. Darcy, does that resonate with you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And a lot of the reason that I think that genre fiction, not only as a writer, but as a reader, appeals to me so much is just because I spend like hours daydreaming. And yeah, there's really nothing more deep than that for me. I just enjoy like playing with the imagination of these worlds that you can create. And yet they're so familiar too, like they have to be.
Stephen, what about for you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Jemison about that. We all need to go to a little place like that in our heads and our hearts, and some of us ride our way back out of it, you know? Mm-hmm.
Darcy, do you find a freedom in having the option to rewrite history?
Mm. Yeah, and a lot of the, there's some elements of Alatziwe that are almost echoes in this alternate universe of things that have happened to my family. And without getting into too many details, for example, there's a scene where the mother is thinking back in her childhood and this encounter she had with this man with a knife and how this ghost woolly mammoth saved her from that situation. And that's something that actually very similar, something happened to my mother, but in her case, it was her little friend who saved her. But the man who was trying to basically abduct them was never brought to justice. He got away. You know, he was never crushed by this woolly mammoth. And so a lot of this is me trying to use this story to say, what if we had these powers that were able to like empower us to seek justice in this country that is so often just stacked against us. And I don't get too much into family personal things, but yeah, a lot of it I think is me like even subconsciously trying to exorcise these demons, like, oh, I wish this had been the way it was instead of the way it actually was.
Hmm. Well, we're talking with two Native authors who are reimagining speculative fiction, Stephen Graham Jones and Darcy Little Badger. And Stephen, I just have to mention before we go to break, my producer says your book, Mongrels, scared the bejesus out of her. So you're doing good work.
Wonderful.
We heard from Kelly, who says, thank you so much for this discussion. Ultimately, fiction is a powerful tool to transport us into the minds, thoughts, and feelings of people we will never be. But it gives us a powerful tool to practice empathy. We need more empathy, especially now. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment. So for years, the publishing industry has been reckoning with a history of gatekeeping that's kept writers of color from getting published. Darcy, to what extent do you feel like the recent changes in the industry have allowed for your work and the work of other Native authors to get noticed?
Yeah, and I do think that for me, I've had a much easier experience as a debut writer, especially of what fantasy mystery, which is not what people typically associate with Native lit. So I was talking to some older writers who debuted much earlier, and they're like, yeah, we had a lot less support than you. There was a lot less people who were giving us the freedom to explore like realms of fantasy and science fiction, and were kind of boxing us in about, I was just thinking how Stephen's comment about how there's many ways to be a good Indian. Well, there's many ways to be a Native storyteller. And yet in the past, there was almost like gatekeepers trying to put us into boxes. You have to write about, for example, like the suffering of people, you know, it's, yeah. So I do think in that way, I have had a pretty cool experience. I do think that there's ways to go, especially when it comes to supporting and introducing emerging writers. So that's something that I'm personally focused on. Like I want to give the opportunities that I've received to new writers, maybe young writers or students, people who want to continue this movement forward.
Stephen, what's your experience been like with the publishing industry?
You know, I guess I've been doing it for 20 years now, and I've been in genre fields, and I've been in literary fields, and all the fields in between, I guess. And I've had pretty good luck, although Darcy's 100% right that the marketplace, whose taste is kind of informed by the critical establishment, I guess, does want us to write stories that trade in, I don't know, trauma, drama, poverty porn, and they always want us to wrangle with like the politics of identity and history, and then we get wrapped up in who is and isn't an Indian, and it can be also distracting when I just want to tell a fun story with lasers and werewolves, you know?
Well, you know, part of the work of Native authors in this genre is about visibility, but what about undoing misrepresentation by non-Native writers? How much do you think about that when you're writing something new, Stephen?
You know, when I'm writing something new, the thing I have to be most loyal to is creating characters who are real, and to create a character who is real to people I know anyways often does mean undercutting the cliches or stereotypes or whatever. But I don't, of course, have like a checklist of, you know, I've got to come back against mascots, I've got to come back against, you know, this and that. My characters, being real people, have their own grievances with those things, and so they end up getting on the page. But
I think we dropped Stephen's line. We'll get him back in just a moment. You know, Darcy, listening to Stephen there, it occurs to me that, you know, this is also an issue of the fact that there's not one Native experience. Mm. So how does that maybe complicate the way publishers and the industry, you know, understand you as authors?
Yeah, and one thing that I think would help with that would be to have more like Native editors or Native publishers. I do believe that Heartdrum is addressing some of those issues, which is really cool. But it's been difficult. I was interviewed by a Lipan Apache interview for the first time ever a couple weeks ago, and it was just such a cool experience because there's some things that she got because we'd both lived it that I didn't have to like explain or anything like that. But yeah, it's difficult sometimes, especially because I at least I'm aware of Elatsoe is the only book with a Lipan Apache main character that's like a fantasy. If there's another one out there, I'm looking for Rex. Find me on the Twitter. But it is difficult because I don't want people to read this story about a young Lipan teen. But, you know, she's written as an individual. You know, she loves comics. She's asexual. She's got her own, like, family dynamics and beliefs that apply to her as an individual and not necessarily culture-wide. And I am worried that people will read this and think, oh, all Lipan people are like Ellie. Mm. They're all like this. And I'm like, you know, no, there's a lot of variety with all people. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah. And Stephen, you were talking about, you know, how you think about, you know, undoing misrepresentation by non-Native writers.
Yeah. I mean, it feels weird to see yourself on the page in a way that isn't accurate, if that makes sense, you know? And so I do always want to come back against that because I'd much rather have the reader, who is possibly not going to be Native, not have to, like, I don't know, be asked to resubscribe to these John Wayne ideals of who is and, or what an Indian is, I guess, what a Native is. And so I can't help but come against that in my fiction, of course.
Yeah. Well, we got this tweet from Brenton who says, the descriptions of these books sound to me like fantasy. I know that fantasy and sci-fi genres are often lumped together. So what is the distinction? You know, we've been using, Darcy, this pretty big umbrella term of speculative fiction because, Stephen, you know, your book is a horror novel. But, Darcy, how do you think about it?
Yeah, so my next book that I'm writing takes place half in this world of like spirits and monsters and half in the near future Earth where it's dealing with things like the effects of climate change, because like as a geoscientist, of course I had to go there. But what this makes me think of is that oftentimes in Native fiction, I use the term speculative fiction because it's very difficult to pin down a genre in a way that's like classically defined. And I think I've found the term indigenous futurisms very helpful with a lot of the things that I write, especially when the characters are living in a world that takes place in the future, but it's not necessarily strictly science fiction. And I do encourage people to look into Indigenous futurisms, maybe start with Grace Dillon's Walking the Clouds anthology, because Dr. Dillon was the person who coined this term. And it is different than strictly science fiction, although Indigenous futurisms, some of the works can, you know, be classified as science fiction.
Stephen, what about for you? Any recommendations?
For how to distinguish between all the genres?
Or even books that people can read to you know, get their library going.
Oh, you know, well, I mean, Grace is, you know, Darcy's right. Grace Dillon's Walking the Clouds is a wonderful starting point for that. Really, I'm always a fan of hitting the primary stuff, just hitting all the, reading all the books that everybody's writing that are set in the future or set in a second world fantasy or set in a haunted house or whatever. And instead of having to, co-opt someone else's definition, mm-hmm. you kind of, after reading enough books, come up with your own working definition. And I think that, to me, is always more valuable, finally.
Well, we got this email from Thomas who says, I've been reading horror for 30 years. I started with Stephen King as an 11-year-old. I don't scare easily. And the only good Indian scared the heck out of me. Lying in bed next to my sleeping spouse, I was still looking over my shoulder at the foot of the bed for the Elk Woman. Thank you so, so much. So Thomas, thanking you there for scaring him. We also heard from Lou who says, as a native listener, I appreciate this segment. I would also recommend, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, Sherry Demoline and her new novel, Empire of Wild, and of course Tommy Orange's There, required reading for all Native and non-Native folks alike. And we'll make sure we tweet out all of these recommendations at the 1A. Darcy, I want to talk about the way you incorporate tradition in your writing. Part of your inspiration for Alatsiwe was traditional Lipan Apache stories. Tell us how you build on them in your work.
Yeah, and so Alatsiwe is about a 17-year-old girl, you know, in contemporary times, but also tells the story of Ellie's sixth great grandmother, the woman who kind of learned how to wake up the ghosts of animals. And she was a heroic figure in that she helped people and she dealt with some of the monsters that were living in, you know, pre-colonization / early colonization United States. And those monsters, I based them heavily on the monsters that would appear in the stories that I heard growing up. For example, there's this lake monster that's actually river monster that's in multiple stories in the Rio Grande. And it takes various forms, but the main takeaway is that it'll try to drag you or your horses into the water and drown you. So there's this monster that sixth grade encounters who is basically that monster with my own twist on it. But I do have to emphasize that I was very discriminating in which stories I chose to incorporate into a fantasy novel, because I'm not going to characterize, for example, our creation story as fantasy. And if you look at the stories of Lipan people and also other peoples, like some of them are very clearly to entertain. Like there's some coyote story where he just like gets up to just some vulgar, like hilarious stuff. And so that's not the same as our stories that are intended, for example, to teach our cultures, to teach the creation of the earth, things like that. So it was me thinking what would be appropriate for me to put my own spin on in a fantasy novel, and what do I not want to characterize as fantasy because it's not.
We're talking to Darcy Little Badger and Stephen Graham Jones. I mean, Darcy, where or who do you gut check that line with?
Oh, my mom. A lot. And there were some elements of the book, for example, the language. We're revitalizing our language. And there's no fluent speaker of Lipan left. And in fact, lots of words are that we know of, they're gone. So what we're doing is we're trying to put together what we do know and kind of piece it together with similar words from other Apache or even Navajo languages and create a Lipan that people can speak in the future. So we're trying to help our language continue. And I was so afraid of accidentally like misspelling a word. I had to contact our tribe linguist and work with him on making sure that what I represented in Alatsiwe is what we're using going forward. So yeah, there were some things when, even though I'm in my 30s, sometimes I still need to get the advice of my mom, who is much wiser than I am.
Don't we all? So yeah. I hear you saying it's part protection and part preservation, and that's sort of the line you're walking in your writing. Stephen, you know, the question of tradition is something you wrestle with a lot in your work, especially in The Only Good Indians. What's your ultimate takeaway about tradition?
My ultimate takeaway, or my ultimate push possibly, is that, you know, I think if you're making the traditionalists nervous, then you're doing the right thing, you know? In The Only Good Indians, these guys are throwing a sweat, and they keep trying to ask themselves, is this the way the old-time Blackfeet did it, or is this just the way we're doing it? And I think that you have to always be looking ahead to, I think it's okay to use a cooler in your sweat instead of, you know, something ceremonial and passed down for 150 years, because my feeling on it is that if ceremony and ritual don't adapt to fit the times, then they become frozen in time, and they just get brittle and they break. They don't have any function anymore. So that my characters, The Only Good Indians, they make fun of the fact that some Indians think there's a great Indian police squad in the sky that's going to swoop down and give you a ticket if you say this wrong or do this wrong or let a woman into the sweat or whatever it is, you know?
Darcy, what do you hope young Native readers take away from your work and young readers who aren't Native?
My biggest hope for like all readers is that they have a fun experience reading Alatsue, that they're able to go on this adventure with this hopefully compelling mystery. I am a big fan of mysteries, and I hate it when you could like immediately guess all the twists. So like I hope that Alatsue accomplishes that. And I do also hope that it, as an earlier comment said, either encourages empathy for people who are different, but also human. Like, we're all human. We share this human experience that varies in different ways, but we are human. But for Native readers, that maybe they can see an element of themselves that is very rarely portrayed in mass media. And maybe that can be encouraging. I hope so.
Stephen, really quickly, I know both of you are involved in creating a special edition of Marvel Comics called Marvel's Voices, Indigenous Voices, that's designed to celebrate Indigenous history. It'll be on sale next month. Can you quickly tell us about that project?
Yeah, Marvel got hold of us and they said, hey, do you want to write an Indian character that already exists here in the Marvel Universe? And Darcy and I and Rebecca Runhorse, we all jumped on it because we all love comics, and it's so wonderful to get to crawl inside these characters and tell their story in a way that feels good.
And Darcy, is it a bit of closing the circle for you, considering the connection you have to comics?
Yeah, that the moment I spoke to the editor, I was like, I want to write Danny Moonstar. And you're like, okay. I'm so grateful for that.
That's Darcy Little Badger. She's the author of Alatsue, her new debut young adult novel. Also with us, Stephen Graham Jones. He's the author of The Only Good Indians, a new horror novel. Stephen, Darcy, thanks so much for speaking with us. We appreciate it. We'll wrap on this email from Julie, who says, please keep presenting shows about sci-fi and fantasy and prove to people that the genre is moving forward in interesting ways. We'd be happy to. Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. Today's producers were Catherine Fink and Emmanuel Johnson. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.